it's amazing how history reaches out into the present. I was present at the first of the big hermeneutical hui's that our province has been having for quite some time up at St John's, Auckland. And in the little group I was put into, I discovered to my surprise the vicar of Matamata, an evangelical member of the reform group, so well and truly on the, as it were, the right of the evangelical spectrum, began talking about the grand ejection, the great ejection, which is going to be part of our topic today. And I was the only other person in the group who knew what he was talking about. In other words, we had a keen sense of that to be an Anglican is to be in touch with our history. And we both knew about Richard Baxter. And as that hui went on, that small group went on, it turned out the vicar of Matter and I had more in common than anybody else in the group. And as I talk about the life of and times of Richard Baxter, maybe it'll become clear why Anglo-Catholics and evangelicals often find common cause. Well, I want to begin, as I always do, with the background situation to our protagonist's life. And we're now a generation on from where we were with John Donne. We're now approaching the end of the reign of King James I, the beginning of the reign of King Charles I, and we're going to be thinking about what happened during the Civil War, during the Cromwellian Protectorate, and then during the restoration of the monarchy after that. And Baxter lived through all of these times, quite a long life. Now, at the end of Elizabeth's reign, Puritanism, which had been the dominant force in the Church of England, was beginning to ebb. It was a declining force, but it hadn't gone away. And when James I came to power, the Puritans insisted that this was a great chance to make a new beginning, and they wanted to meet with James to get things sorted out in a thoroughgoing program of reforms for the Church of England. Now, James I was a very adroit manager of church affairs, and he called the famous Hampton Court Conference of 1604, where, as usual with these things, a great deal was said, and very little was promised or followed from it. And then a few years later, James looked for a wizard wheeze to kind of deflect all the energy of the Puritan protest, and he said, we're going to have a new translation of the Bible, and it will incorporate the best of all the learnings of the other translations that will be, and will also have a comprehensive rejig of it all. And thus it came to be that the King James Bible came to pass. This wasn't what the Puritans had asked for, but it was a brilliant deflection strategy, since he appeared to have answered some of their interest and concern for biblical religion. Well, when James he eventually dies, and then his son Charles I comes to power in 1625, a date always easy for me to remember because Father Carl's put it in on the answer phone thing at the vicarage, and you have to plug it in to roll your messages back. And Charles I was a handsome man, but not terribly bright, and certainly not politically astute. And Archbishop Laud, who he appointed as Archbishop of Canterbury, between the two of them, they tried to make a kind of mild counter-reformation, all of which was blundered because of their lack of judgment. But I don't propose to get into mired in the history of why Archbishop Laud in the end ended up being executed by the Long Parliament. But I'll say this, whenever I look at Anglican Church and look at altar rails, I think Archbishop Laud. He's the one who put altar rails in. Because we have to remember that in many communities in England, the parish church was the only community meeting place. There was no village hall to go to. And Archbishop Laud, quite understandably, didn't want dogs and other pets gambolling around the altar, or irreverent behaviour disturbing the solemn and appropriate celebration of the services. So that's why the altar area was fenced off with altar rails. Well, where things really began, the wheels began to come off with James, with Charles, is that he tried to govern without Parliament. That was difficult because, of course, Parliament was required to raise taxes. He got into a disastrous war with Scotland because he tried to impose the prayer book on Scotland and the Scots rose from revolt. He lost the war, had to call Parliament, and steadily found, as the Long Parliament, as it was called, went on, that he was losing ground. And in particular, of great interest to the Long Parliament was the reform of the Church of England. They had these wonderful committees in those days. They set up the Committee for Scandalous Ministers to investigate vicars one after the other who were below par, doctrinally, morally, and every other way. And in 1642, this was replaced by the Committee for Plundered Ministers, since so successful had the committee been that it had sacked a considerable number of clergy. The upper estimates would be somewhere between 2,000 to 3,000 vicars had been ejected from their livings. And the problem now was to provide for these indigenous vicars. Well, this was the point at which Charles said, enough is enough. I am now going to raise my standard. I'm going to call my loyalists together for the sake of saving the Church of England. And so it was that in 1642 he raised a standard at the city of Nottingham and the Civil War got underway. 3 years later he had lost the Civil War, and the parliamentary victory high on their agenda now is the religious settlement in Britain. So it is that in 1645 Parliament orders the abolition of the Book of Common Prayer. It's replaced by the Directory of Public Worship. In 1646, Parliament abolishes the episcopacy. There are to be no more bishops in the Church of England. Parliament, of course, ties itself up in knots and finds it hard to govern on its own. And in 1653, Oliver Cromwell steps in and becomes the Protector of England, in other words, the sole ruler of Britain. He proceeds to win a series of wars against Britain's enemies and rules single-handedly for a long period of time between 1645 and 1660. So by now, the episcopacy has been abolished, the Book of Common Prayer has been abolished, and most interestingly of all, the church calendar has been abolished. So these are the years which Christmas got scrapped, for instance. In other words, the idea of using time to teach about the Christian year has gone. We don't have Lent or Advent or the seasons after Trinity. So, and a fascinating experiment gets underway now about an alternative religious future for Britain. And there's a proliferation of Protestant options going on in these years, not just the Presbyterians and the Puritans I was talking about, but also the Independents, the Baptists, the beginners of the Unitarians, and of course those wonderful names of the radical section of the army, the Diggers, the Levellers, the Muggletonians. Now, they were the more radical elements meeting in the parish church at Putney to debate Britain's alternative future. And you know, the left-wing leaning Labour MP, Tony Wedgwood Benn, the great bête noir of the right-wing press in Britain, he dates the beginning of real parliamentary democracy in Britain to what took place in Putney Parish Church with those more extreme members of the new model army. That for the first time, the idea was that all men might be equal in Britain and might have a genuine say in the running of the country. Of course, they caused that chaos, that's why Cromwell felt it was necessary to step in and rule alone. Now, the contemporary historian Judith Maltby, in an essay entitled How the Old Church Grew Its Backbone, begins to argue that people grew to love Anglicanism by its absence. They particularly missed the abolition of the church year. They were particularly annoyed about the fact that you couldn't celebrate Christmas. And this had been a bad misjudging of the sensibilities of the English people. Whereas, for instance, Parliament retained the celebration of Armada Day, celebrating the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1688, and it retained the celebration of Gunpowder Plot Remembrance Day, the genesis of our Guyfawkes Day. So, but also what had happened, Maltby argues, is the Book of Common Prayer had now worked its way into the devotional and mental furniture of the English people. And so it was the clergy, maybe they weren't allowed to use the BCP, some of them memorised large chunks of its baptismal and funeral liturgy. And there was one guy, the Reverend Hackett, later to become the Bishop of Coventry and then Lichfield, who did so and was called upon to officiate at the funeral of a very well-known Puritan. And this is the report of what happened. There being a great concourse of men of the same fanatical principles as the deceased, when the company heard all delivered by him, the Reverend Hackett, without book and with free readiness and profound gravity, they were strangely surprised and affected, professing that they had never heard a more suitable exhortation or a more edifying exercise, even from the very best and most precious men of their persuasion. The assembled godly were aghast when Hackett revealed to them that not one syllable had been his own, and how all was taken word for word out of the very office ordained for that purpose in the poor, contemptible Book of Common Prayer. Now, we might add that some churches continue to covertly use the Book of Common Prayer anyway. As is always the case in any great change, there are some parishes where the vicar says, I am far from the bishop, I am far from the king, I will do the outward bare minimum necessary to conform, but things will go on round here more or less the same they always have. You know, the greatest powerful force in the church's life, inertia and entropy. So What did happen, though, was that the bishops tended were not made of a heroic mould. They faded away and exercised few attempts to keep the remnant and rump core of the Church of England going. Though some vicars got themselves covertly ordained in a kind of top-up process, you know, a bob both ways, more grace abounding, just to cover their options. So the secret ordinations. Jeremy Taylor said, never had the excellency of episcopal government been so obvious now that it was lacking. There was called localism, a lack of regional leadership now that bishops had gone, and Richard Baxter would try to address this issue. There were stubborn, uncooperative clergy and laity who kept the Church of England going covertly, particularly amongst the country squires and gentry. In 1660, the Restoration occurs. Cromwell dies, his son proves out to be an inadequate ruler, the Parliament's been suspended for a long time, the radical experiment has run its course because it's failed to generate a new generation of leadership. The restoration of Charles II is very popular, it's a bloodless revolution. In 1662, the Book of Common Prayer is slightly revised into its present form and is restored again through the Act of Uniformity. And then the great ejection occurs. Estimates vary. Was it 1,000 or 2,000 vicars were booted out? In order to stay on, you had to have been episcopally ordained or to agree to be episcopally ordained. You had to accept the governance of the church by the episcopacy and by the monarch. And you had to accept the Book of Common Prayer and its associated doctrines. Now, it's in this era, you know how you go to say some churches in Britain, it's a great royal coat of arms above the altar. This is when all that starts. A very visible symbol, we are back in the driver's seat. You know, the monarch and the bishops are in control here. Really rubbing people's noses in what had happened. And in between 1673 and 1678, a series of test acts exclude dissenters, as they came to be known, those who would not accept the new arrangement from central government. We turn now to the life of Richard Baxter, who lived between 1615 and 1691. He was born in Shropshire, and his confirmation in 1632 was a pivotal moment in his life. He was confirmed by Bishop Thomas Morton of Lichfield, and he reported this way. It took place in a churchyard and in the parish pathway. As the bishop passed by, we knelt down, and laying his hands on every boy's head, he said a few words. Now, it was medieval precedent here. Often medieval bishops wrote this, that, you know, that some of them barely dismounted from their horse. People had been assembled at crossroads outside a village. But to put it mildly, Baxter was unimpressed with what had happened and determined that this was not a satisfactory entry rite into the full responsibilities and privileges of the Christian faith. And he would later argue that confirmation, if it was to be retained, ought to be by adult believers owning their own faith before the local congregation. Ironically, this is the place the Church of the Province of New Zealand has now got to in its confirmation discipline several hundred years later. Well, after a somewhat informal and a different education, Richard Baxter was ordained into the Church of England in 1638 and assisted at Bridgnorth Parish Church. Now, in those days, those are on the more Puritan extreme of the church, and it wasn't whether you wore vestments or not. The four tests were, was the vicar prepared to wear a surplice, you know, the white garment over a cassock? Was the vicar prepared to allow wedding rings to be offered at the wedding service? Was the vicar prepared to make the sign of the cross on the baby's head having splashed it three times with water? And was the vicar prepared to kneel at communion? Well, Baxter refused to make the sign of the cross at baptism. He would not wear a surplice, but he was prepared to kneel at communion and to use to allow the use of a wedding ring in a marriage rite. You see, marriage rite and the sign of the cross, all this is taken to be remnants of Popish religion, as indeed it was. He's on the staff of Kidderminster Parish Church, but gets ejected from that job by royalist troops in 1642 and becomes a chaplain to the parliamentary army, though he does have his frosty moments with Oliver Cromwell during those years. He returns to Kidderminster as the vicar in 1649 and he allows the sequestered former vicar, one Charles Dance, not a movie star, but the vicar from the parish, to receive £40 a year, one-fifth of the living's value, and allowed him to read the Book of Common Prayer to the local gentry who wish to still receive the ministrations of the Church of England. So he's moderate and tolerant in this kind of outcome of what had happened in that part of the world. Actually, State of Kidderminster was, and it's renowned for carpet manufacture and also the silk industry is based there. In by nature, he was hypochondriacal, very interested in his health. He had a pessimistic nature. He was not very practical. He was a passionate controversialist. And it said his zeal often overcame his tact, and his olive branches tended to be fired from a catapult. In his ministry at Kidderminster, he had a powerful preaching ministry. Quote, he talked from the pulpit with great freedom about another world, like one that had been there, and was come as a sort of express from thence to make a report concerning it. He said of Lancelot Andrews' sermons, who we talked about in the first lecture, that they did but play with holy things. A preacher ought to speak with life and light and weight. He was also a hymn writer, and the two hymns, Ye Holy Angels Bright, and He Wants Not Friends That Hath Thy Love, are what has survived of his hymns. We sang both those hymns last Sunday in preparation for this lecture. That's unusual that he was a hymn writer, because this is an age when Puritans tend to think that metrical psalms are what you sing in worship. That is to say, you take the psalms from the Bible, you set them into rhyming verses, and you sing that. He wrote a Reformed liturgy, we'll be turning our attention to that later, which some would argue is higher in its doctrine and more Catholic than the Book of Common Prayer. In his church, communion was received sitting. Christmas was not observed. And he was mightily interested in who should be worthily admitted to baptism and communion, a real baptism conundrum. The issue of discipline is paramount in his pastoral ministry, and so he answered it this way. He and his assistant systematically catechized all the parishioners who were willing for this to happen, at the rate of 14 families per week, with the intention being to teach the people by question and answer in their own home situation, so as to make sure that they knew the basic teachings of Scripture. He aimed to cover all 800 families in the parish in 1 year. This is pretty formidable, in terms of discipline. And of course, the great thing is, this is intentional pastoral ministry. It's not just busy drifting along, how's your health, how's things going? You have arrived with a purpose, and you are clear that you're going to make sure that that person's up to scratch. And this becomes the test of whether you are able to receive communion. You don't have to be catechized this way, but then you can't receive communion. There's also public discipline and excommunication for notorious sinners in the parish. In instituting at Kidderminster both the discipline and the pastoral oversight without which discipline could not be justified, he was a pioneer. Other ministers, first in Worcestershire and then more widely, showed an increasing willingness to attempt something similar. The model of discipline he adopted was similar to the one used in congregational churches, but he was against their schismatic way of gathering a congregation out of the parish and thought their qualifications for church membership were too strict. He then tries to expand this kind of discipline on a regional basis by forming what's called the Worcestershire Regional Association of Clergy in 1652. Now, what happens here? The regular meetings of the clergy in that locality, where they hold what's called a disputation or an exercise to instruct and inform young ministers. Remember, there are no theological colleges. A lot of these clergy haven't been to Oxford or Cambridge. They would consult together about overcoming differences about discipline, worship, and doctrine. In other words, they try to get a standard policy right across the area. They deal with any complaints against clergy, members of the association, in matters of scandal, false doctrine, or maladministration. They make sure that a person ejected from one congregation couldn't quietly join up with another. That's a common front in the matters of excommunications or bootings out. They have a common front too on admission to communion and baptism. In other words, they've overcome the present problem we have with the associational nature of the Christian church. I've fallen foul of this church, I just go down the road, join up the neighbouring church and just pick up where I left off. Inexperienced young ministers unused to public reproofs or standing up to difficult members of their congregation would be counselled and advised by older clergy who might even come to their assistance. And each association would send delegates on a quarterly basis to a bigger meeting in Worcester to sort out the biggest differences. So we can note here that this Worcestershire Association is exercising many of the functions that a bishop would. It also sets out to answer a conundrum which has been there in Anglicanism right up to the present day. And I'll come back to that in a minute. There were 73 members of this association, of whom he estimates three were moderate independents, one was a Baptist, three or four were moderate conformists, the old episcopacy, and the rest were what he called mere Catholics, men of no faction, not siding with any party, but owning that which was good in all as far as they could discern it. So, at the Restoration, about half of these clergy complied with the Act of Uniformity. His best-known book, The Reformed Pastor, written out of a special day of humiliation, as it was called at Worcester, in order to ask God's pardon for their neglect of the duty of catechising and his assistance as they now undertook it. Now, in this period, the Quakers, who we think of as being very peaceable and erratic people, are making a real nuisance of themselves. What the Quakers would do would be to turn up in twos at churches and disrupt public worship. What's going on around here is wrong! No. And they were all kicked out, and this is the time when they become very unpopular. Also, this is why the associations needed to evangelise and to secure against false doctrine in every part of the country. So, then comes the Restoration, the years of eclipse for Richard Baxter. First, Charles II appeared to promise that he would try and be moderate and try and include the people who'd been in the driver's seat during these 15 years of the Cromwellian Protectorate. So, Baxter was made chaplain to the king, along with other Presbyterian divines. And there follows what he called 3 months of hopefulness and 30 years of inactivity and disgrace. There was an act passed for confirming and restoring of ministers. At first, only 300 clergy were immediately affected, but it affected Baxter right away, who was ejected from his living at Kidderminster. He was offered the bishopric of Hereford, but he turned it down, as this would remove him from the task of working for reconciliation. If he'd taken the king's shilling, he was on the winning side, he couldn't be seen to be agitating for the Puritans. He wanted church and episcopacy not to be restored in the old form, but a form of primitive episcopacy acceptable to him. The following year, he's a member of the Royal Commission to advise upon and review the Book of Common Prayer, out of which very few changes came. This was known as the Savoy Conference, for which Baxter writes his own alternative liturgy, which the Reverend Ratcliffe said was more Catholic in many ways than the BCP. Now, Baxter was not a shrewd or accomplished ecclesiastical politician, but he could sense, as the Savoy Conference proceeded, that the Puritans were losing ground and that King Charles was going to outwit them. But he thought it was important to state that case for posterity. Well, the Act of Uniformity is then passed before the conference ends, which requires complete conformity to the Book of Common Prayer. This is the revolt of the country squires who'd been taking it on the chin for 15 years during the Cromwellian Protectorate, and now were in no mood to compromise, no mood to let the king try and strike a deal, and they insist that the Church of England be restored as it was. 1,600 of Baxter's former parishioners signed a petition to ask him to be allowed back into his parish, just ignored, and Charles Dance, the former vicar to whom mercy was shown, is not willing to allow Baxter back on any terms. He goes to see the Bishop of Worcester to see if he can get a job, and he's refused a licence to preach in the diocese. The great ejection begins in 1662 with the Act of Uniformity in final form. Now, there was a really interesting lecture about this by the Reverend Gerald Bray at the Otago Theology Department last year. He argued that there were not quite as many ejections as we now think, and that this grand policy of the vicar so often used of keeping their head down, pretending to conform, just going on the way they always had, was took place more than you might suppose. Baxter had been episcopally ordained and therefore and was not opposed to the Book of Common Prayer in principle, but he will not conform to a church which intends to exclude. The 1663 Conventicle Act forbids meetings for religious purposes other than according to the Book of Common Prayer with more than four persons present beyond the members of your family. Shrewd. Acton in London, Baxter is accustomed to preach on Sunday after going to a Book of Common Prayer service at the parish church, and then he invites his neighbours and friends to his house for a sermon. He says, 2 years earlier, as I was preaching in a private house where we received the Lord's Supper, a bullet came at the window among us and passed me and narrowly missed the head of a sister-in-law who was present. In 1669, he's arrested and briefly imprisoned at Clerkenwell under the Act of 1665, prohibiting ejected ministers from coming within 5 miles of an incorporated town. In 1672, Charles II declares indulgence to nonconformists, permitting meeting places for worship, but teachers had to be licensed. Baxter is reluctant to apply for a license because, after all, this was intended to grant relief to Roman Catholics, and it means that you've kind of gone on the government's books. The effect now is that dissent is becoming a hard lump, defining itself out against the hegemonistic Church of England. Now, in these years, one good piece of fortune has come to Baxter. He meets and marries, I think her name is Margaret, and it turns out to be a very happy marriage, which sustains him through these difficult years. And Baxter's wife had a series of schemes to try and keep his ministry going, such as renting houses so he could preach in private rooms, and equally ingenious methods were used to try and overcome his services, so drummers would gather outside and beat their drums throughout the service. Judge Jeffreys, the famous hanging judge, imprisoned him in 1685 at Southwark. He was released in 1686 and bound over to keep the peace. In 1689, an act of toleration is passed. He still opened his doors morning and evening to all that would join him in family worship, and he dies in 1691, apparently having failed in all he set out to do. But what can we conclude about the career of this remarkable man? Well, first of all, as a thought-provoking exemplar of outstanding pastoral practice, intentional ministry, thorough, methodical, the local vicar intent on raising his people to high standards of scriptural literalness, and answering the Puritan conundrum about people worthily receiving the sacraments. His book, The Reformed Pastor, is still read and appreciated by evangelical clergy. He had solved the Puritan dilemma about an appropriate discipline as a gateway to baptism and the Eucharist, but Anglicanism rejects this discipline as sectarian. Now, in the last lecture of this series, we're going to hear how Charles Gore, the great Anglo-Catholic bishop, also became deeply frustrated on this score in the early 20th century. He said, if anybody is going to serve on a vestry or a PCC, as they call it in Britain, if they're going to be a church warden, if they're going to exercise any role of responsibility or governance in the church, they ought at least to be confirmed, and they ought to be regular communicants. And the Church of England says no. We all found that very frustrating. So the problem is that the Church of England has now accepted a rather slack and lackadaisical style of operating. And as I was asking on the pebble last Sunday, did this condemn the Church of England now to lukewarmness and slackness? In other words, the kind of clergy who were going to be there in the 18th century were guys who were prepared to kind of, just conform, just do the bare minimum necessary. Baxter had an ecumenical vision. He disliked fanatical division. He had a desire for a comprehensive, tolerant and inclusive church, which has been common to all the other framers of the Anglican identity we've talked about. He was pretty minimalist in his requirements for what you might require to be a part of the Anglican Church. That you could agree to the Apostles' Creed, be prepared to use the Lord's Prayer and the Decalogue and the Ten Commandments. Remember Lancelot Andrews had asked more. He said, we are the church with 5 identity markers. 2 testaments, 3 creeds, 4 centuries, 4 councils and 5 centuries. Was he then too broad and minimalist? But his vision for a comprehensive and accommodating church was a rebuke to the Church of England that Restoration had ceased trying to be the nation of prayer, but accepted dissent as a marginalised reality that would now be the hegemonistic, dominant national church. In other words, we've given up trying to be the church for everybody. We accept that there's Protestant diehards over there. The dissenters would halve in numbers over the next century until the advent of Wesley and Methodism and the rise of evangelicalism and the creation of heartfelt religion transforms the situation in the late 18th century. And I'll be talking about that next week. How, for instance, Methodism saw a fourfold increase in numbers between 1790 and 1815. A non-ejecting Church of England is a fascinating alternative of what might have been in church history. That's what the Vicar of Matter was saying to me. It would have been better if the grand ejection had never occurred and the Church of England had found a way to keep all those vicars on board. If Anglicanism is reformed Catholicism, that's the historic and reformed Catholic features as a major ingredient of his religion. He accepts private episcopacy, an increasingly desired episcopal pastoral ideal today, which has been proclaimed especially by Eastern Orthodox theologians such as John Zizulis and Nicholas Afanasiev. This is the idea of the bishop who knows all his flock and whose Eucharist constitutes the church. In other words, this, you know, that first was the first two centuries. The bishop celebrates the one Eucharist in that town to which all Christians go, and the deacons and presbyters are merely his assistants. This was really what Baxter was pressing for. He was not opposed in principle to the Book of Common Prayer. His Reformed liturgy was more Western Catholic in its theology than the BCP. He had a strong theology of the communion of saints. You know, as an Anglo-Catholic, if somebody asked me, well, what do you mean by communion of saints? And I read out this hymn. He wants not friends that have thy love and may converse and walk with thee, and with thy saints here and above, with whom forever I must be. Within the fellowship of saints is wisdom, safety, and delight, and when my heart declines and faints, it's raised by their heat and light. As for my friends, they are not lost, the several vessels of thy fleet, though parted now by tempests tossed, shall safely in the haven meet. We still are centred all in thee, though distant members of one head. Within one family we be, and by one faith and spirit led. Before thy throne we daily meet, as joint petitioners to thee, and in spirit each the other greet, and shall again each other see. The heavenly hosts, world without end, shall be my company above, and thou my best and surest friend. Who shall divide thee from my love? Was this the brand of Puritanism that could make its home in a reformed Catholic church, and why wasn't it allowed to? The Worcestershire Clergy Association was a model for Anglicanism of the missing middle component of diocesan clergy life. The archdeaconries of today, or the regional deaneries as they're called in the Church of England now, never quite work in the same way in terms of pastoral support, collegial friendship and fellowship, and in terms of training opportunities. Deadly archdeacon meetings when it's been to for the last 32 years. Sit in a circle, how are things for you to? And rarely ever do clergy fess up in an honest way. It tends to be what the Archdeacon of South Canterbury called exhibitions of bitching and bragging instead. Well, that didn't tend to happen in the regionals of Worcestershire Association. Emerging Anglican clergy culture would turn out to be rather too independent. Was this an associational antidote that has never been tried? Baxter represents Puritanism at its best. The Cromwellian Protectorate had given them their chance to show what they could do, to get in the driver's seat and complete the Reformation. But according to Judith Maltby, the generality of people hadn't been that impressed. They wanted Christmas back again, thanks very much, and the traditional customs and usages that went with the times and seasons of the liturgical year. They'd acquired a taste for the Book of Common Prayer, and for common worship. They liked a good sermon if it could be had, but if it wasn't the be-all and end-all of their religion. The Puritans had won their case about the importance of an educated clergy who could preach and teach, and big progress was being made in implementing this vision. Lay people were becoming scripturally literate, but they weren't going to be calling the shots and choosing clergy, apart from squires, or running the local church in the way that was happening in emergent Presbyterianism. Emergent Presbyterianism had been seen off as the model for governing the Church of England. But what would happen to the triumphant national church when the monarch lost interest in managing the church, and when a parliament that cared less than it formerly had began to interfere in the life of the church in ways that offended highly motivated church people? The 18th century would see the end of the concept of the divine right of kings and the rise of a parliament that wasn't much interested in the connection between throne and altar. This would set the scene for igniting the tinderbox in a way that would give rise to the emergence of the Tractarians. The world that would give rise to Charles Gore, who I'll be talking about in my last lecture, would then come into being. You know, it's the Church, the Irish Church Temporalities Act in 1833, in which Parliament set out to reform some quite major abuses of the Church of Ireland that would give a cause to John Keble to preach the famous Assize Sermon that would launch the Oxford Movement. But more about that later. We now, therefore, come to the end of the 17th century. Next time, I'm going to leap a century and begin with the beginning of the 19th century as I talk about Frederick Denniston Morris.